During the past 30 years, there's been a growing list of pop and rock musicians trying their hand at musical theater. And they range in style and scope from artists like Cyndi Lauper, Dolly Parton, and Elton John, to rock bands like The Who, Green Day, and The Go-Go's. Well, today's guest has been venturing into musical theater and is from a band you may not have heard of, but their name is certainly one you're not likely to forget, The Slants.
Hey, my name is Simon Tam. I was born and raised in San Diego, California, but I live in Cincinnati, Ohio now. Many things. People call me an author, an artist, a musician. I oftentimes like to say that I'm a troublemaker.
Now, Simon has only recently begun his transition from rock star to musical theater writer, and he shares why this new artistic endeavor is so important to him. But his path getting there has taken some surprising turns. We'll talk about the bullying he faced as a child just because he's Chinese, as well as a couple of million-dollar contracts that he and his band turned down. And we'll also cover the famous 8-year trademark battle that ultimately landed him and the band's name at the Supreme Court. It's what branded Simon as a troublemaker, a name he now wears as a badge of honor.
Oftentimes people associate the troublemaker as if that's a negative thing. And I'm like, the people who push back, the people who dissent, oftentimes are doing some good. If anything, it's forcing us to take a second look at the status quo and saying, like, is this actually what we want?
Welcome and thank you for joining me for another episode of Why I'll Never Make It, an award-winning Top 25 Theater podcast. I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, an actor and singer, talking with fellow creatives each episode of personal struggles and professional hardships with lessons we can all learn from. The website is whyillnevermakeit.com, where you can subscribe to bonus episodes and offer your own financial support to the production of this podcast. Again, that's whyillnevermakeit.com. Welcome, Simon. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's an honor to meet you as well as have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, as far as your relation to theater, you've been a performer for a while, but you've been more on the musical end, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, I played bass in high school for a show choir that did a lot of musical numbers, you know, things from Les Mis, Rent, and that sort of thing. So I was familiar with a lot of like musical theater, and I've always enjoyed attending theater just as an avid fan, but have never really been involved on the theater side of things until just recently.
What recently has come up for you?
Well, right now I'm developing a musical theater show for the No Theater of Cincinnati. We kind of debuted a work in progress at their Fringe Festival last year. And I've been kind of performing at a couple of other Fringe festivals, playing around with storytelling and songs, but we're really going to be bringing it to the stage. I think right now we're slated for the fall 23 to 24 season at the No Theater. And then, you know, we might tour and take it elsewhere. Although for me, as somebody who only dabbles in acting at a very, very limited degree, I think it'd be even cooler if we can write something that is compelling enough and interesting enough for folks where it provides the opportunity for other actors to take on those roles. Because I speak with a lot of like young Asian American actors, and there just aren't that many roles for them. In fact, our last lead singer that we had, one of the reasons why he joined our band was because he was a musical theater kid. Like he majored it in college, worked at a theater, and he would audition for these roles in LA. And he would walk onto the stage for things like Les Mis, and they wouldn't even let him sing. And they'd be like, no, you're not right for this.
Which is so strange because Lea Salonga has been attached to Les Mis for decades now. I know she's just one person, but at least that's something.
They would just see this Japanese guy walking on a stage and you know, he got one role in Rent. He had to play the traditionally black role, and he got a couple roles in Cats because he was made to look like a cat.
In makeup.
Yeah. And the rest of the time when he worked at this theater, he took tickets and swept the floors, and it broke his heart. And I was like, how many stories are there like this? And what can I do to change things? If I could write something that allows more people to have roles and parts, then that really would allow the art form to live on in a different kind of way. So I would love to be able to do that. In fact, my guitarist and I wrote a new album, and for the first time, we decided to change this idea of what it means to be in a band. Our album is actually going to feature lead singers from throughout the country, like young Asian American artists that are up and coming that we've been working with through our foundation. We're like, what if we used our band's platform to give some more attention and, you know, more ears to these other artists that we think are really cool? Like, that would be even better for us. And it's our way of thinking through, like, how do we allow this band, how do we allow the stuff we create to continue to live on and impacting other generations and for the future. And so that's behind a lot of my thinking these days. It's like, how do I create work that opens doors, or at least makes it a little bit easier for somebody else coming up?
Well, we'll get right into story number one that you wanted to share. And this one's actually a tough story, in the fact that as a child, you were bullied and even violently attacked as a kid for being Chinese. Now, who exactly were these bullies, and why did being Chinese bother them so much?
So growing up in San Diego in the 1980s, we didn't have the kinds of representation that we do today. The kind of representation that we did have in things like books, film, television, oftentimes just portrayed these ridiculous stereotypes, oftentimes extremely negative. This is also during the 80s, when there was just a lot of violence towards Asians in general, mostly because the Japanese automobile industry was taking off and causing some kind of U.S. brands like Ford and Chevy to kind of go in the decline. So there was a lot of resentment towards people who kind of look like me and members of my family. And I think that kind of carried over as a kid growing up. So a lot of times I'd kind of get into fights, or like bullies would just chase me around the schoolyard. I mean, it happened a number of times. Sometimes as early as fourth grade, I'd be walking home from school and people would be waiting and jump me and take my books and that sort of thing. So it happened pretty frequently. And most of the time it was accompanied with racial slurs as well. They oftentimes like to call me a Jap for a gook. And, you know, there's a one particular time I kind of yelled back and I was like, I'm a chink. Like, that's how stupid you are. You can't even be a racist properly. And that's also when they stopped. Like, and I realized there's just a lot of power in being able to claim your own identity and say, you know, I should have agency. I determine who I am, not anybody else.
Yeah, it's interesting. The same thing happened recently with COVID. Just any Asian was seen as being blamed for, you know, the Chinese virus, as some would call it, or this or that. And it became derogatory to be Asian at that time, you know, that some people would blame. And so how did you, as a kid, I mean, as an adult, we can kind of process things and realize that they're just idiots in the world. But as a kid, how did that affect you and what you thought of yourself?
Well, I mean, I became really ashamed of my culture. I didn't want to speak in any of my first languages. Yeah, English is actually my fourth language. I grew up speaking Mandarin, Taiwanese, and Cantonese. And I just didn't want anything to do with my culture. So even the most treasured and important holidays that were part of my family, I didn't really want to participate. I was just really deeply ashamed. I was ashamed for having these eyes or this facial structure, and didn't really find any pride in my cultural heritage. Not until I actually moved away from San Diego as an adult. You know, once I was kind of isolated and wasn't around anyone who looked like me, wasn't around my family, I actually started missing it, started realizing that it was an important part of who I am that I needed to embrace and to kind of grapple with and figure out like what parts of that part of my identity. Cause I was both Chinese as well as Taiwanese as well as American. And like, how do I figure out like those different parts of me, you know, cause they're all a part of me and I shouldn't like shut them off just because other people wanted to treat me a certain way or to just treat me as a stereotype. So it took a good couple decades before I think I fully came to a reckoning of like who I was as a person.
I think that's something that can be difficult for those of us born here that aren't immigrants or children of immigrants, that there is that duality that comes of having one culture or heritage versus another. And then, of course, when that's made fun of or bullied as you were as a kid, then it can seem even more othering. So is that something that your family experienced as well, the sense of othering, not just you?
Yeah, I think, but with a different perspective. Like for my parents, for most of their life, they're like, well, we're from another country. So it was almost like, oh yeah, we moved here. Like to them, it's just like, that's fine. And, you know, my parents also experienced some pretty harsh racism in their life too, but it was almost like they were, for them, that was the price they had to pay to give their children a better life. And so they endured it in a much different fashion than for me or for my siblings. We're like, we're born here. We're just as American as everybody else. Why are we experiencing this? And it wasn't our choice. We didn't choose to move here. We didn't choose to like grow up in this kind of environment. It was just inherent day in and day out. And so I think also growing up in it versus moving as an adult is different too in that regard. Like I was like, I don't understand why my English teacher never calls on me in class, but the math teacher always calls on me, even though I have no idea what's going on. Like, you know, it's like dealing with that kind of stuff that I just thought was a bit ridiculous, but it was just something I had to learn how to navigate.
In coming to terms and accepting your culture, was part of that addressing those stereotypes, either wanting to break them or confront them in some way?
Yeah, I think that was definitely important for me. You know, and there's a lot of people who approach it differently. Some people do it with anger, which oftentimes is understandable because it comes from a point of deep pain. Other people do it through inflicting self-harm. You know, I would say I was in that camp for a long time. But there's other people who use things like humor or art to kind of deconstruct those ideas and push those notions back in the faces of dominant groups and say like, you know, hey, why do we think like this? What, is this actually reflecting the kinds of values that we claim to hold? And I think when I began to process things as an adult and as I kind of dove more deeply into art and, you know, expression, I started realizing, you know, maybe that's the more effective way of doing things is like using art and expression as a way to kind of create common values that people can connect with. And if I could somehow share my experiences in a way that other people can understand through their lens, maybe that can elicit a little bit more compassion, or at very least get people to change the institutions and the systems that perpetuate these kinds of ideas.
Yeah. As a kid, was music a refuge for you as you were experiencing this bullying?
Oh, it was totally. It was like an outlet. I mean, I think that's why I gravitated towards like punk rock. Like it was this idea of like being an outsider, of kind of being rejected. And the one place where you could feel there's a little bit of power, because it was about like taking agency. It was about saying like, hey, you know, even the term punk rock, right? It was a very derogatory term. And then all these kids are like, you know what? We're going to take that. We'll be punks. We'll make it a cool thing. And I was like, oh, like I think some spirit of that really resonated with me. And that's probably why I felt the way I did in terms of like seizing control of my identity and using that to push back in the faces of my bullies and saying like, you know, there's a little bit of power in that. And when you feel powerless, you take what power you can get and you just grab onto it and hold onto it. In many ways, that kind of defines you for a time.
Well, that actually leads us into story number two, which is you reclaiming a certain title for yourself and your band. And it's probably one of the things that you're most known for is when your band's name, The Slants, was at the center of a massive 8-year legal battle with the U.S. government. Now, first off, why did you and your band members want to call yourselves The Slants?
Well, I think it kind of stemmed from those childhood stories. right? Like when I was thinking of wanting to start like a band that would celebrate Asian American identity, which I would say it took me a while to get to that point in my life. But once I was actually there, I started asking all my non-Asian friends, hey, what's something you think all Asian people have in common? And they would always say slanted eyes, which I thought was interesting because it's like an untrue stereotype of Asian people or people of Asian descent. And also like there's a lot of non-Asian people with like, you know, slanted eyes. So I thought, well, it was these eyes that got me beat up all the time. I always associated them with shame and embarrassment, fear and violence. But what if we could flip it around and change the association from that like shame and embarrassment to self-empowerment and pride? And what if we use it to kind of like shine the light on this like really kind of ridiculous stereotype and get people to like think more deeply about it, to question it? So we wanted to kind of reappropriate this term and change it into something a little bit different. And so that's kind of the genesis of the band's name. And I guess it was kind of a little bit of a like punk rock move, I guess you could say.
Right. And so this all started very simply. You had the Slants as your band name. And so you wanted to trademark that name, and which seems like a very simple process, but you ran into a hurdle right away.
Yeah, I mean, it's supposed to be normal. It's supposed to be a few $100s, takes like 6 months, but it turned into something very different because I didn't know it at the time, but the government had this 70-year-old law they called Section 2A of the Lanham Act, which says you can't register trademarks that are considered scandalous, immoral, or disparaging. And they said that our band name was disparaging to persons of Asian descent. And it was pretty shocking when I first heard it because I was like, wait, do they know we're of Asian descent? Like we were touring, we were playing at Asian festivals all across America. We were doing like anti-racism workshops and diversity inclusion trainings, oftentimes on behalf of the US government. So I was like, what are they talking about? And they actually didn't have any evidence to support their position other than an entry in urbandictionary.com. And so we decided, hey, I think they're wrong on this. Let's fight back. Let's push back on this idea.
Because how long had you had the name Slants before this trademark case?
3 years before I applied. And so we were already touring. We were on, NPR. We were on like 700-800 radio stations getting plenty of play. Our story was out there. And we had never once received a single complaint. And even though we were playing for, you know, hundreds of thousands of Asian Americans every year at like different festivals and conferences and things like that. So it was like really like kind of a surprise when I got the rejection. And that just launched us into this extremely protracted legal battle against the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
Now, at any point in that, did you think about, well, it doesn't really matter because you certainly could have gone on touring with the Slants name without it being trademarked. So what made you want to keep going on with this fight?
Well, originally we wanted to get a registered trademark because there were other bands that were starting up calling themselves the Slants. And it was, and our fans are buying tickets to the wrong bands. And we would tell them, hey, like we started before you, we've had this name. And they would refuse to change their name and venues would refuse to like give fans money back. And so it became really confusing for a minute. Now, also our lawyer was kind of explaining to us, like, if you want to be able to get a record label deal, if you want to get sync licensing, if you want to do all these things, you have to have a registrable trademark. So that's why we applied. And then, you know, when you get told, like, you can't have something that you think should be rightfully yours, one will end up pushing back because it's like, hey, this ought to be mine. And then as we learn more and more about what, you know, how the law is being used, you know, we finally like changed the question instead of arguing with them, like if you're offensive, because we had like dictionary experts and national surveys and all these studies conducted. Everyone was like in favor of our band. The government just continued to double down on their position. So we started saying like, well, why are you saying it's offensive? Because you've actually given Slant as a trademark out hundreds and hundreds of times. Like, what is it about this band that is problematic, whereas Slanted Records or Slant Shack or Slant No Rant or all these other trademarks he given out, like, why were they okay? And the government came back and they said, it's because you are too Asian to use the mark. They said,
wait, because your band was all Asian, you're just too Asian.
You're too Asian. Because in their minds, if people saw us on stage and they saw the name The Slants, they couldn't help but think racial slur instead of any other possible definition. It's just a really convoluted way of saying anyone can register slant as long as they're not Asian.
Which seems strange to me. It seems that a white band or a black band would have a harder time using a slur.
It's very counterintuitive. In fact, later on, years later, one of their legal briefs, they said it wouldn't have been an issue if we were an all Caucasian band. And so, you know, when I heard that, I was like, oh man, they're using our race against us. This is even more wrong. And then I found out that the law was mostly used against people reappropriating terms. So it ended up being the majority of people denied trademarks were people of color, women, the gay and lesbian community. And so I was like, okay, this is extremely messed up. Of course we got to fight back on this thing. And so that's why we continued to persist. And despite like the fact that it was draining our resources, I actually had to walk away from being a full-time musician for about 6 years to continue fighting the thing so I could take like side hustles and other things.
Was your band able to keep touring during this?
We continued to tour and release albums. We just didn't tour as frequently. So we went from touring like 6 to 8 months out of the year to like maybe 6 to 8 weeks a year.
Oh, wow. So did this create any tensions or disagreement within the band because of it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because a lot of my band members, well, that's not what they envisioned for a music career. You know, they wanted to play music. They didn't want to be in this major court battle. I mean, some of them got girlfriends and that will break bands apart too. But, right. But you know, like they all left for their different reasons. And while they were still supportive of the work, I got it. Like, that's not what you want to do with your life. And I was already in it. And I was like, well, I can't walk away from this. Like, we have an opportunity to change this law, to flip it, to shine this light on like how it is actually unjust. I can't just walk away.
And so what was it that finally got you to the Supreme Court? And when did you get a sense that you were finally going to win this case and it be done?
Well, we eventually went through the entire like legal process afforded to us, which is through the trademark system itself. That's what the trademark office, and then they have their own kind of court they call the Trademark Trials and Appeals Board. From there, we went to a federal court and the DC district, and there we actually won. So 9 out of 12 federal judges actually struck the law down, saying it was unconstitutional, that it violated my First Amendment rights. And so we won, and I thought it was over. But 6 months later, it was actually the government that sued me. The Department of Justice and the Trademark Office filed suit, took us to the Supreme Court. So I didn't have a choice.
Right.
That's how I ended up at the Supreme Court. But going in, I was like, well, we already have this one victory. It seems like the law and the truth is on our side. We were also going up with a court with only 8 people in it because Scalia had just passed away. So it was a 4-4 split because there was an even number of like conservatives and liberals if they were going by traditional, like, you know, partisan divides. Even if they ended in a tie, we would end up winning because of the Federal Circuit decision. So I was like, okay, the odds are kind of in our favor, but you just never know with those things.
Right. But it turned out to be a unanimous decision in your favor.
Unanimous, yeah, which was pretty surprising to me. But, you know, I was obviously extremely excited about that.
And so after this court case, I'm curious, obviously there's, you know, you can finally use the slants. You're the only slants out there, so all these other bands can't use it. But did it in some way help with touring dates, getting the band back together again? And of course, that's not why you did it, but did it have that financial gain as well?
I get asked this all the time, and I'm like, unfortunately, people who listen to NPR or read the Washington Post or, you know, read my op-ed in the New York Times, those don't oftentimes translate into concert ticket sales or album sales or that sort of thing. In fact, if anything, being stuck in this legal battle for almost a decade ended up being a major distraction from our work, both creatively and limited our ability to perform. So I'm not sure if it helped us much other than I know in 2017, which is the year we went to the Supreme Court and the decision was made, our tours started looking very, very different. So whereas in the past we'd play rock and roll clubs every night, we'd sometimes play an anime convention or some kind of Asian American cultural festival. Now about 60 to 70% of our tour dates were at law schools and for American Bar Association events. And we would play a venue, a rock and roll venue, maybe once every 3 to 4 gigs. And so most of the demand for us wasn't for us to play a show. It was for me to go speak about our journey. And I had to convince them to let the band play. Say hey, I'll give you a discount on my speaking fee if you let the band play so we can sell some t-shirts and CDs or do something. So it helped in some ways, because there was a very high demand for a while for me to speak. And I would go to law panels and that sort of thing, and we would get the band to play. But it was pretty disheartening for a lot of members of my band, because I would speak and then we would play, and then people would just go and get drinks and network and walk away. Mm.
So obviously this was in some ways your battle, but did it feel like the band was behind you? Or as you said, you lost members here and there, but overall, did it feel like the band was with you in this battle, or did you feel alone?
I'd say I felt pretty alone. I mean, the band members were supportive, especially in the last couple of years. They all went with me to DC. We were all in the courtroom together, but it was my name that was on the case. I was the one reading every legal brief and consulting with our legal teams and that sort of thing. They were just kind of we just show up and play the music. Simon can handle all the other stuff. And so it felt a bit isolating because I didn't think they really appreciated or understood everything that was going on. And it made it oftentimes difficult. And it kind of started driving a wedge in the band in some ways, because it was I didn't want to be the person front and center. I mean, I play bass. Who knows the bass player of most bands? Right. And now I was, the limelight was shining directly on me as opposed to the band. And so it made it kind of difficult at times. I mean, many newspaper reports, including the opinion of the Supreme Court, they called me the lead singer of the band. And I was like, I'm not the lead singer. And that's for a very good reason. And so I think it was difficult. It probably was not easy for my band members who wanted to be known for music, not a law case, and who wanted to be known for their respective talents, not being the people who were in Simon's band. And so there was no fault of anybody, really. I mean, it was just a situation that we were in, but we needed to find a way to continue to press on. And I think that's also what kind of just started shifting the priorities in my life in terms of what it meant to be in a band at all. I started realizing maybe the biggest accomplishment of the band and most important thing that we had to offer to the world wasn't actually our music, our art form and our craft that we cared so much about. Maybe it was our story, the persistence of overturning an unjust law.
And so in the years since that court case, has music been able to be more of a focus for the band again?
It was for a minute, but we actually retired in 2019 from live touring. And, we didn't know that there was a pandemic that was going to erupt and take away live performances anyway. But the singer and his wife, they're pregnant, and that was going to limit touring. And I think we just kind of knew, we started winding down a bit. And really, so in 2018 and 2019, most of my appearances were just with my guitarist. We would just do these acoustic duo shows. I would speak, we'd play some songs, and that was it.
Born down in a dead man's town. The first kick I took was when I hit the ground. And up like a dog that's been beat too much till you spend half your life just covering up. Born in the USA, I was. Born in the U.S.
I also realized that I was burnt out. I was touring for, you know, almost 15 years of just living out of like a tour bus, and, you know, my work day, so to speak, wouldn't be over till like probably 2 or 3 in the morning, because like we'd after loading out, and then I'd spend 10 hours driving, setting up and repeating it over and over again. Now, when I just spoke and we played our acoustic gigs, we were done before dinner. And I was like, hey, this is way more sustainable. Like,
right.
This is kind of nice. And in fact, one of my last tours, I took my wife and my dog came with me. And I was like, I don't have to like spend all this time in a, driving a tour bus. Like it was just way easier. And I also allowed me to just do things solo. And I just realized that, okay, the idea of like being a rock star wasn't in the cards. Like it just was tired, and I just needed to do something a little bit different.
Well, you've taken on the moniker of Troublemaker, and this was actually a name that was bestowed upon you, right?
Yeah, by the government.
And so how have you embraced that moniker? Just like you embraced the slants and fought to be able to use that, how have you embraced Troublemaker as a part of your identity?
Well, I mean, it's in the title of my memoir, right? It's Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court. I actually have it on my business cards. It's on my LinkedIn page, because I feel like whatever I choose to do, whether it's the nonprofit work I'm engaged in, whether it's the art I'm creating or otherwise, in many ways, I like to defy cultural norms and systems and expectations. And the process of doing so oftentimes is a bit of troublemaking in of itself. And I realize that like oftentimes people associate like, oh, that's a troublemaker, as if that's a negative thing. And I'm like, you know what? The people who push back, the people who dissent oftentimes are doing some good. If anything, it's forcing us to take a second look at the status quo and saying like, is this actually what we want as a community, as a culture? And if not, then getting us to question those norms is actually a good thing. And so that's why I really enjoyed embracing that term, and to pay honor to a lot of troublemakers in the past who stirred things up for good, especially the late Congressman John Lewis. He would oftentimes say, make good trouble. I decided to take that as an honorific and say, you know what? I want to stir up trouble. I think it's good to push back. It shows a deep love and compassion for other people when we say that the system that we have isn't actually designed to serve everybody. And we need to make trouble, so to speak, by creating a better system for other people.
While each of us is familiar with the basic process of a theater audition, figuring out the casting, so to speak, for a rock band is a little different. In this week's bonus episode, Simon walks us through that rigorous process he set up for those wanting to join the Slants. I think it'll make you have a kinder and more grateful appreciation for how easy we as actors have it. To get this and other bonus episodes, just go to whyillnevermakeit.com and click subscribe. There you can become a monthly or yearly subscriber and show your support for Why I'll Never Make It. Now, that title has certainly been true for myself and this podcast, but with your support, it'll certainly help make it a little easier.
In 2008, the Slants were offered 2 different contracts that you eventually turned down. Now, the first was through the Bodog Music Battle of the Bands, and was for an opportunity to be featured on the Fuse TV reality show and win a $1 million recording contract. Now, at this Battle of the Bands, the Slants consistently placed first in every round of the competition, so really you were on your way to ranking near the top or possibly win the competition, right?
Yeah, I can actually say that after the last round we were involved, they actually gave us the contract. So they wanted us to go through the motions of continuing the competition nationally and on this reality show they're filming, but they already chose the winner, and that was our band. So we had the contract at hand.
How far before the end had they already chosen you, really?
Well, so they started the competitions in cities, then they went to regions. So we won all the Portland competitions, and then We went and won the ones for the Pacific Northwest / West Coast. And so what they're going to do is take all the national winners, about 10 of them, have us all go to LA and then tour across the country while they filmed all of us as part of this like reality TV show, kind of like American Idol, but on the road. And, you know, and then they would pick a winner at the very end. So we were right before filming the show. And I was like, this isn't fair to the other artists. And also the contract is terrible.
Yeah. What in the contract made you not want to take it?
It was a 10-year, 10-album deal.
Which sounds great, but...
But the $1 million is for that entire 10 years.
Oh,
and
right.
They also got to control the budget. So we would have to use their recording studio, their producers, their marketing team. And then they would also own all the rights to our merchandise, our name, and any subsequent bands that we, if we disbanded and started new projects, they would own the rights to those things as well.
Oh, so if all of you disbanded and each of you formed your own band, they would still have a piece of that?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So it was pretty awful. Like I sent it over to an entertainment attorney and I was like, hey, could you take a look at this? And he wrote me back 15 minutes later. And he's like, this is the worst contract I've ever seen in my life. And he's like, in my entire career, I'm like, it took him just a few minutes. He's like, I wouldn't touch this. He's like, you should ask them for the Word doc so that we can actually do like a red line, you know, negotiation, like talk about some of these points. And I asked for that. And they said, this is a non-negotiable contract and it's exclusive and that sort of thing. And I was like, okay, no, thank you. And then the president of the record label actually called me on the phone and he was kind of berating me in that and trying to like entice me. And he was just like, don't you want to be on a record label? Don't you want $1 million? And I asked him, I was like, this is a kind of a pretty bad deal. And I was like, everything you're promising, we're already doing for ourselves. We're already touring. We're already on the radio. So what can you actually do for me that I can't do for myself? And he couldn't answer the question. I was like, well, when you figure that out, you can call me back.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the visibility of being on a reality TV show, that was probably the only perk. But yeah, you had already accomplished much of the music business stuff on your own without using them.
Yeah, we already had a gold record. We're doing plenty fine without them. So I was like, why do I want to give up my entire future and put it in the hands of this person that I don't really trust?
Yeah, I've heard similar things when it comes to the American Idol contract about the things that they make them sign, you know, as they get further along into the competition and how much they own of different people. And it sounds like it's somewhat of the same thing. They're trying to basically take advantage of people who may just be getting started out, have no other resources to do it. And so they said, well, we're your only shot. So you got to give us everything.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I mean, this happens all the time in the arts, right? Because we rely on gatekeepers, whether it's a major publishing company for your book or maybe a film studio or a record label. Like we think like these are going to be the folks that break our careers and allow us to like hit the mainstream and have success. But what most folks don't realize is that it puts us in debt and indebted to those companies for the rest of our lives. And so many people you would think like, you know, like, oh, you're selling millions of records here. You got number one New York Times bestseller, all this other stuff. You don't realize that like, well, the money isn't going to the creators. Like I knew somebody who was on the top of the New York Times bestseller list for months. And they said like, oh, they got $50,000 over like a period of 5 years. And like, that's not even a sustainable living. They had to make their living teaching English at a college and from like speaking. And that was how they, you know, the book gave them the validity and credibility to get those positions, but they weren't reaping the rewards from that.
Well, the second contract that your band turned down, this was in that same year, 2008. Now, this was for a bit bigger deal. This was $4 million. It was a recording contract that was offered to you. However, it had a very strange condition in needing to replace the lead singer. What was going on with this contract?
Well, in many ways, it was a much better deal. I mean, it was a more traditional record label offer, but they had a condition. They wanted to replace our lead singer. And they specifically wanted us to replace our lead singer with somebody who is white. because they said that Asian doesn't sell. And I'm like, yeah. And right before this, you know, I was talking to the A&R rep and there's like, we love everything about you, you know. And I'm like, so you want to sign an all Asian American band only to replace the lead singer with somebody who's not Asian? Like, I thought, you know, this is pretty messed up.
Like why? And, why? Like, I'm trying to wrap my head around it. So they love your music. They love what you do. They know you're the slants, Asian American. So why would they then want to change something that they obviously like and want to record with?
But they like the fact that we were touring and getting radio play. They like the music. But I think they genuinely thought that America would not accept an Asian American singer. I mean, if you think about this time period, this is like well before K-pop, like no Asian singer really had obviously Asian singer had been on the charts or on the covers of any like major music magazines or anything like that. So it was like, they thought in order to help us to make the odds more favorable, we needed to have a different front person. And they probably wanted to minimize our association with Asian culture. Even though that, you know, that was what we were. I mean, you know, a lot of bands get kind of makeovers or they get their sound refined a little bit to make them more mass market, more friendly to general populations. At least that was the thinking for the music industry for many years. I mean, even Elvis Presley, right? They had to depart from Sam Phillips, moving from playing music that was associated with Black culture. They wanted to like refine the edges, so to speak, and make him more palatable to other people. I think they were trying to do something very similar with us. And I don't think it was intended to be malicious. I mean, they were even like, you know, if you sign this, your parents could retire right now. I mean, I was just like, oh, this is just feels so wrong. And so I just ripped it up and I was like, no, like, I was like, this is racist. And I'm going to prove you wrong one day. One day we will be in Rolling Stone and Billboard and all these other things, and we'll do it without you.
I assume the band was 100% behind this decision.
I never told most of them for many years.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
So it came to you directly and you just decided to not even go with it.
Yeah, because I was managing the band. And so I was handling a lot of that. And I was like, oh, this might create some resentment and division in the band. So, because like maybe some people wanted me to sign it and it, you know, technically could have paid the lead singer off. But I was like, no, I knew the potential that we had and I wanted to trust that we would be able to make it. And this is even before we, you know, even started applying for our trademark.
Whenever you did start telling members of the band, what was their reaction?
They were supportive. They got it. And I think we don't really know what would happen anyway. I mean, you know, if we signed it, maybe the terms would change a little bit. It's funny how like in hindsight, there's all these opportunities that at the time you're just facing this decision. You don't really quite know if it's like what's going to happen one way or another. Like around that same time period, We just got invited to play at South by Southwest, major music festival, especially for up and coming acts. At the same time, we're invited to open with this then relatively unknown artist named Lady Gaga. And I was like, Lady Gaga? That's the person from MySpace.com who does these fashion videos. Cause I looked her up and I was like, no, we're totally doing South by Southwest.
So it was going to be one or the other?
Yeah, it was because it happened at the same time.
Okay,
like, no, we're going to Texas. And then 3 months later, the single for Poker Face dropped. And I was like, did we do the right thing? You know, did we make the right decision? And then like, you know, this happened time and time again. Even a couple of years later, someone that I know was doing publicity for this up and coming indie rock band. And I was telling my band, I was like, hey, we should play the show with them and maybe do a tour with them. And I was like, I think they're going to really blow up. I'm like, I'm listening to their songs. They're really good. I think this is going to be a big deal. And my band members were like, no, you don't know what you're talking about. And that band turned out to be Imagine Dragons. Yeah. And again, less than a year later, you know, they dropped Radioactive. And I was like, You should have listened to me.
See?
You
should, See? You should have played
this. But you don't know at the time because, you know, we would get offers all the time to play with this act or that act or to play one festival or another. But like, you really can't know until like in hindsight. You're like, oh, maybe that would have really worked out.
Well, now explain this to me as far as opening up for a band. Obviously, then you're associated with whoever the main act is. And so that can be its own, you know, getting audiences to know who you are. But at the same time, how then does that translate to you going on your own and becoming a big name yourself without just being attached to that main band?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of kind of people who are in the upswing in their career will oftentimes open for these other artists to get a little bit of cachet, like say, hey, we played with such and such artists. So it oftentimes helps them book their own gigs later on. But if the artist does really, really well and you continue to have a relationship with them, maybe you tour with them or that sort of thing, it allows you to get in front of bigger and bigger audiences so that hopefully some of that audience translates into your own fan base, which kind of drives momentum. It's almost like being able to tour or play with the Kingmaker, right? Like you, all of a sudden you're like, hey, I'm playing with this very high profile artist. That automatically means that I'm instead of playing in a club for like, you know, 150 people, I'm playing for 1500 people worth, you know, 10,000 people. And so it allows you to just like build momentum more and more quickly.
What would you say was the biggest thing that you did or that your band played in that got your band the biggest notoriety and fame throughout your touring career?
I think initially was the fact that I booked us to play at anime conventions, like super niche audience, right? Like, and especially in 2007, 2008, like nobody really thought geek culture was cool at the time period. Like this is before Big Bang Theory. And I was like, wow, there's like thousands and thousands of these people attending these things. And they care about Asian culture, or they're at least interested in it. So if we could somehow like get in there, that might work out for us. And we started playing them, and we would play for, you know, anywhere from, you know, 500 or 600 people to sometimes like 10,000 plus attendees at a time. And it would allow us to sell just a ton of merchandise. In fact, the very first like national story on our band was on NPR's All Things Considered, and they talked about this band that was touring and playing anime conventions.
The Slants' breakout gig came last year at a convention devoted to Japanese animation. These conventions, or cons, draw thousands of young anime and manga fans, many barely into their teens. They're decked out in costume, ready to spend, and starved for music.
And what's funny is like we were known as the anime convention band. Like we played more than any other band in the world, but we actually had nothing to do with anime culture. Like we did not have a song in an anime or in like animated movies. We didn't cover anime songs or anything like that. We just started booking them. And because of the association, because I'd book one event and then I'd talk to another event and say, hey, we played their event. And so they're like, oh, you must be okay. So we just started playing, you know, 30 to 50 events a year. And if we actually use them to anchor our tours, like we play rock and roll clubs throughout the week. And then we play like a big festival or convention at the weekend. And so I think that was probably one of the most impactful things that we did as a band, at least early in our career. Cause it like a ton of like news stories were written about us for this kind of weird novel thing.
How interesting. Well, as you said, the band is no longer touring, and this has given you a chance to really focus on the Slants Foundation. Now, what is its main core and mission?
So we decided to launch the Slants Foundation really in, like, I would say we started working in 2019, and we wanted to really focus on the intersection of arts and activism, particularly with underrepresented communities. And so probably the majority of our work is with Asian American artists. We try and help them through funding their projects, through mentoring them, through connecting them with other artists or people in the industry so that they could have a career that is scalable and that is sustainable. And so we work with across all mediums, but obviously with like majority musicians. But that's just been a bigger and bigger focus every year. We just kind of come up with new projects for a few years there during the pandemic, where we saw this rise in anti-Asian violence, we started funding projects, like artistic projects that would share stories and would elicit empathy and drive conversations about Asian American identity. And this year we're focusing on civic engagement, like working with artists to write songs that drive people to the ballot box and to write songs about issues that they care about.
Well, it certainly sounds like that in these decades since your childhood, you've certainly learned to embrace your Asian heritage and culture, and now you're advocating for others as well. So it certainly seems like you've come a long way in these past few decades.
It seemed like every endeavor, every fight was a new lesson learned to eventually get me to this place.
Well, thank you, Simon, so much for sharing these stories and for coming on and really giving us a different view of another side. I certainly am a theater podcast, but it's always good to talk with other artists about what they're doing in their journey.
Yeah, and who knows, maybe I'll become more of a theater artist myself.
Right. I look forward to these musical things that you're working on. Well, thank you so much for sharing everything that you shared today. It's been a real joy to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining me and Simon Tam today. And don't forget, the conversation continues with that audition story bonus episode, as well as on Instagram, where I'll be posting extra segments from this interview. You'll find links to both of those in the show notes. Well, I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. And be sure to join me next time for the season 6 finale with Phantom of the Opera's Jeremy Stoll as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.